according to the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, the ADAA, 18% of Americans are afflicted with anxiety. General anxiety disorder, GAD. That's like the low-level anxiety. GAD is similar to dysthymic disorder for depression. It's that low-level anxiety. Counselors would define anxiety in these terms: fear in the absence of actual danger. If we never felt fear, we probably would be dead by now. Fear is actually a defense mechanism to help us avoid danger. Anxiety is different. Anxiety is the other realm where we're feeling bouts of fear when there is no danger. There's a book called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. The premise of the book is zebras do feel fear. When? When a lion's there. When a lion is about to bite off their leg, is about to bite into their thigh, they feel fear. The thing is, they don't feel fear for the future, and they don't feel fear from the past. They feel fear when they're in the presence of danger. I think it kind of fits with Jesus' statement from Matthew 6. Do not worry about tomorrow, for today has enough worries of its own. Yes, we can plan. We can be responsible. But to sit and worry about tomorrow, that's not the way of Christ. It's not what he wants from us. Anxiety disorders are classified as neurotic rather than psychotic. Psychosis means that you have lost touch with reality. Anxiety disorders are neurotic. That just means that reality is out of kilter. It's you're amplifying parts of reality which are real. Psychosis would mean you think something is trying to kill you which doesn't exist. Or you think something happened which never happened. Anxiety disorders would include panic disorders, obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, social phobias, post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD for short, and then GAD, generalized anxiety disorder. As far as the phobias are concerned, acrophobia, fear of heights, zoophobia, fear of animals. There was a woman I knew who, whenever a little dog would come into the room, I mean a dog this big, she would scream and cry and jump up on top of the table. Zoophobic. That's what she is. Claustrophobic, fear of small spaces. Or agoraphobia, think of a big agora or stadium, fear of open spaces. Something like this, you would just feel like there's just too much space, people are looking at you, where's my exit? Have to have your back to the wall. Let's talk about panic disorder. Panic disorder is typified with these symptoms here. Shortness of breath, can't breathe. Sometimes it's they can't inhale. Other times it's as if they can't exhale. It's just they can't breathe out. Heart palpitations. It's your heart is taking off. You can't calm yourself down. Chest pain, dizziness, sweating, shaking, or fear of losing control or dying. People launch into panic disorder, PD for short, and all of a sudden they're afraid, they're in front of people, they get the fear, I'm going to wet my pants, or I'm going to poop my pants, or I think I'm going insane, I think I'm losing my mind, I think I'm going to snap, I think I'm dying. I knew a guy, woke up, the age of 30, shot up out of bed, thought he was having a heart attack, turned to his wife, I think I'm dying. They were had two kids, they're on their second kid, he thought he was losing his mind. He said, I was sweating, heart was hurting. They drove him to the hospital. Doctor gets him, puts him up to the EEG, what is it, EEG and EKG. Which one's for the brain? EKG? No, EKG is for the heart. So they hook him up, doctor tests him. He says, you think you had a heart attack, huh? He said, yeah. He says, okay. Squirts him full of some medicine. About 30 minutes later, came right down to normal. Did I have a heart attack? No, you had a panic attack. Woke up out of a dead sleep thinking he was dying. More on that later. Obsessive compulsive disorder. No, this doesn't mean that you count things or that you tap your fingers or all your shoes are in the right order. Okay, that is a mild neurosis. I think pretty much everyone is a little bit crazy in that regard to some extent. Tapping your fingers, counting, super, super mild version of OCD. True obsessive compulsive disorder is different. Yes, it would include repetitive behaviors to certain rules or rituals. To some degree, most all of us have this. Symmetry, everything has to be symmetrical. You get your lunch tray, everything has to be in the right place. At your desk at work, everything has to be fit. So maybe somebody will come over at work and put his hand on your desk and move something around the desk and you can't think about what he's saying until you move it right back into place. Then we can talk. Hoarding, counting, organization, repeatedly checking something. I know a guy went on a Christian retreat. He was driving there. All of a sudden, he said, I think I left my Bible. The guy said, oh, where is it? I think it was in my bag. Can you check? The guy opens up his bag, in the back seat, one of those hatchbacks, looks in. Oh, it's right here. Don't worry about it. 10 minutes later, I think I left my Bible. No, dude, we just checked. It's right here. 10 minutes later, dude, I'm really worried I left my Bible. They pulled the Bible out. They handed it to him. Dude, it's right here. 10 minutes later, can you just double check? I just want to make sure I didn't leave my Bible. Driving some hundreds, sometimes thousands of miles out of the way, being halfway to work, thinking you left the iron on, the stove on, thinking that the house is going to burn down, driving back, checking. In the 1997 film, As Good as It Gets, Jack Nicholson plays a really good OCD patient. He really captures it well. If you remember, he can't step on cracks. He has to bring all of his own silverware to the restaurant. He, when he goes home, locks the door, unlocks it, locks the door, unlocks it, locks the door, unlocks it, second lock, locks the door, unlocks it. Everything's three times. He has new bars of soap. He's got to wash each hand washing. It has to be from a new bar of soap, and then he throws it out. That's OCD. OCD isn't just counting things or having rituals. That would be a mild form of it. What we're talking about here is when it's actually inflicting upon your life, where all of a sudden you can't get to work without checking. You can't have a conversation without checking, counting. Interestingly enough, we showed in week 6 that Jeffrey Schwartz from the West Coast, with his cognitive behavioral therapy, has made huge progress with OCD. Remember that? Where you rethink these thought patterns to the point where it actually creates different neural pathways in your physical brain. They call this neural plasticity. Whereas your mind starts to think differently, it changes the physical structure of the brain. So Schwartz actually demonstrated from his literature, he said using his cognitive behavioral therapy for patients with OCD, they actually did better than those on medication. Medication's gotten a lot better too. So just imagine if somebody's into this, they can get help. There is a way out of this. Generalized anxiety disorder, you have to have at least 3 of the following symptoms: muscle tension, insomnia, can't sleep, poor concentration, feeling restless or keyed up, irritability or fatigue. Constantly worried, constantly fearing, and to the point where you just can't take it. It is having a physical effect on your body. Can't sleep. You just feel touchy, edgy, general anxiety disorder, and in fact, anxiety disorders in general, panic disorder, OCD, and general anxiety, more common in women, statistically, than in men. Though it is suspected men have it just as commonly, they just don't talk about it. Because they don't want to sound like a weakling or a wuss, that they're afraid. Remember, the only emotions that men have are frustration and anger, right? And so to say, that is scaring me, that is bothering me. Men just don't talk about it. So, they might suppress it. It might express itself through anger. What's wrong with Dad? Jeez, I left the spoon in the sink. And he blows up in anger. That's his way of expressing. Actually, he's anxious about work. Or he's anxious about X, Y, or Z. They also self-medicate. These are the guys that show up to the funeral or show up to the reunion or they show up to the big event stone drunk because they're so anxious they can't talk without pounding a few beers beforehand. Many different causes for anxiety. For one, there's the existential anxiety. Viktor Frankl, the Holocaust survivors, made really good ground with this. In his book, Man's Search for Meaning, he developed a form of therapy called logotherapy, the sense that we need a purpose. And if we're walking through life without a purpose, that leads to anxiety. Why do I matter? What is my purpose? Why am I here? Does it matter if I'm here? Am I significant? Yeah, that would tend to cause some anxiety. For sure. There's circumstantial anxiety. The person who is working minimum wage perpetually can't make their bills. They are constantly controlled by if their car breaks down, if they have a medical bill. Even for those who are rich, those who are very poor, those who are very rich, things come up, bills need paid, and it leads to anxiety. I do believe that there's such a thing also as moral anxiety. David says in Psalm 32, when I didn't confess my sin, my bones, how does he put it? My bones felt like water within me. I couldn't talk. He was filled with anxiety. When you have something on your conscience, when you're with other believers, you do get that sense of anxiety. When are people going to find out? When are the effects of this really going to set in? And that'll make you pretty anxious right there. I think that there is such a thing as demonic anxiety. I do think this is within Satan's bounds. Not that he can cause us to feel the anxiety, but I think he can put thoughts on our mind at certain times where we're weak, where we start to think about things, makes us anxious. Remember working with a guy who we had gone through all the other bases. We went through the biological basis, the scriptural, the identity truths. I mean, you could see this guy was disciplined with God, good worker, one of the best evangelists you'll ever meet. And yet he was still filled with anxiety, terrible anxiety. We started to look more into his history. I mean, we sent him to the doctor. He got pills. They took him up to the maximum dosage. Started at 50 milligrams or whatever, went up to 100, went up to 150. That's as high as it goes for this particular medication. Didn't help at all. No change. Months went by, no change. So we got to a certain point where we started to investigate his past, and it turns out that there was a cult bondage from his grandmother. She was really into the occult. And he wondered if that had some kind of effect on him. I know it sounds superstitious, but if you talk to authorities in the area of the occult, demonic worship, witchcraft, that kind of thing, they will say this kind of stuff can follow you right down the line. We sat there and we prayed. And we prayed that God would release him from any kind of bondage that was there. We rebuked Satan. I can't explain the turnaround. we're talking a 180-degree turn. The oppression was lifted. He could pray. He could be in fellowship. Now he is a home church leader, raised a couple other guys up into leadership at this point. 100% different. So I think the role for Satanology here is that this is one of the factors. We're looking at the biological basis. We're looking at their diet. We're looking at their exercise. We're looking at their giving of thanks. Not all of these are equal. Some are more important, but we're covering our bases. And if we can't find an explanation, maybe there is a supernatural explanation. We should investigate. There's materialistic anxiety. Jesus talks about the worries of the world coming up all the time. Renders believers ineffective. Jesus says there's a whole entire seed. Of the four seeds, one of them is taken out by what he calls the worries of the world and the deceitfulness of riches, which choke the word and it doesn't cause fruit. Maybe a whole quarter of Christians are getting choked out from effectiveness for Christ because of that one right there. Materialism. That'll cause anxiety. There's relational anxiety, not having friends. That'll make you pretty anxious. Not being around people, being inside your own head. There's ministry anxiety. Paul talks about this in his letter to the Corinthians. It says that he merimanao for the churches. He melee. He felt anxious. Of course, our translations always dumb that down. It says he felt concerned. He felt anxious. He had planted all these churches. He's worried about them. Oh, yeah. Ministry will bring anxiety when you start to invest your life into other people's lives. You start to care for them and you worry. There's also learned anxiety. Many of us picked up anxiety from our parents. In a very simple illustration, a little kid with his mother. And the mother, whenever there's a thunderstorm, gets anxious. The kid looks at that and he, thunderstorms, scary. All of a sudden, he thinks that they're scary. You know what we do with our kids? We've seen parents where the kid is a toddler starting to walk. He just looks perpetually drunk all the time, bumping into things and falling. And you've got these super neurotic parents that whenever the kid falls, they... And guess what happens? When you are neurotic about your kid falling, they are neurotic about it. And so you'll see little kids, I've seen this happen, where the kid falls over and the and goes over and picks them up, and the little kid looks back and goes, you know what we do when our kid falls? Good fall, Jack! Good fall! And you pick them up and you put them... Good fall, buddy, yeah. Get back out. We put him back out there. This just happened last week. Our son fell out of the door. Fell on the ground. And I said, whoa, good fall. Picked him up. He just looked at me. Put him back down. He walked right away. My buddy turned to me and said, I can't believe that. It's not that my son isn't a crier. He cries like crazy. But he shouldn't cry at things that aren't that important. Of course you comfort him, but you don't panic. You don't make it a big deal. Learned anxiety. Okay, that's a silly illustration. It's important when you have kids. But think of all the things which your parents prioritize. The things that make them anxious. School, work, career. A lot of these things are important needs. You got to get your career. You got to stop screwing around and finish school. Get your degree. And yet some people, one guy I was working with, 3.9 GPA, freaked out about failing out of school. Panicked about it. Then I finally found out his GPA after years. And I was like, you got almost a 4.0. Now I was thinking, well, he's just really materialistic. No, he wasn't. He's very fearful. He's anxious about delivering good grades. So we can pick up some of this from parents. We can pick it up from our friends, our peers. And it's learned anxiety. Perhaps the premier passage on this topic is Philippians chapter 4. This is by far the best passage. My favorite passage is one who struggles with anxiety. This is the passage you go back to. This is the grounding. Philippians 4. Of course, we've got to get the context. Paul writes this letter from house arrest in Rome. If we know anything about Paul, it becomes abundantly clear that he was a strong-willed personality type. Would you agree? Before becoming a Christian, what were you into? I was into Old Testament legalistic Judaism. Oh, and so what was that like? Well, I was the best of the best, second to none. Remember Philippians 3? There was nobody like tribe of Benjamin, circumcised on the eighth day. As to legalistic righteousness, faultless, hardcore, balls to the proverbial walls, all right? So what were you doing with that? Well, I was going and trying to get letters so I could kill Christians because they were part of a false religion. A Jewish Pharisee going around rounding up Christians to kill them. Then he becomes a Christian. So what does he become like? Docile, boring, lazy? No. Immediately, remember Luke, Acts 9, immediately he began preaching Christ. Immediately, at the end of Luke 9, is it 22 or 25? It says his disciples lowered him down from the wall. He'd only been there for a couple years and already he has disciples helping him. Paul was strong-willed. He was a scholar. He was a gifted leader. I mean, to have the scholarship, the leadership gift, since he even had the gift of tongues. It's just like, did this guy have every gifting there was all wrapped up into one man? And what's he doing? He's sitting in house arrest, chained to a big, hairy, sweaty Roman guard. He should be out there planting churches. There are millions of people who haven't heard about Christ. And he's stuck in a 12 by 12 room under house arrest. I don't know for those of you who are this kind of personality type, but you can imagine being stuck in a situation like that would make you kind of nutty, wouldn't it? I should be out there. I should be doing something. God, why would you have me here? Wouldn't you kind of feel at least a little bit like God's plan had become a little bit unhinged? Like maybe this was out of God's control a little, maybe? The most gifted, scholarly leader in the church, bar none, and he's sitting in jail? You'd expect him to slip into depression, anxiety, worry? Instead, we see him mentioning joy or rejoicing some 16 times in this little book, four chapters. He's mentioning it four times per chapter on average. He is rejoicing out the butt as he's sitting there. At one point he says, these chains of mine, they don't belong to the Roman guard. They don't belong to Satan. Wouldn't you say Satan put me in jail? Like a good Christian in our church. Oh, Satan put me in here. It's probably demonic. Paul says these aren't Satan's chains. These aren't the Romans' chains. These are the chains of Jesus Christ. If I'm sitting here in chains, it's because this is exactly where the Lord Jesus wants me to be. As it turns out, Paul sitting there slowed him down enough to write several of our best books of Scripture. Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians. With a strong-willed guy like this, who didn't slow down ever, maybe he wouldn't have written those books. Unless God put him in prison for a couple years. Then all he can do is just sit there and write. And also, he's chained to a new Roman guard every 12 hours. So he witnessed. One of the things that Justo Gonzalez, one of the experts in church history, points out is that Paul was sharing his faith with those Romans. Those Romans retired and traveled to all the different ends of the Roman Empire, were respected, had property, and had nothing to do. And Paul witnessed all of them. Paul even says, it's in Philippians 1 and then at the end of the letter, all in Caesar's household have heard about Christ because of me. The whole Praetorian Guard, So I guess if I'm stuck here chained to this guy, that means I'm not chained to him. He's chained to me. Remember that scene in The Watchmen? You ever see the movie The Watchmen? Where Rorschach is in prison and he takes that grease thing and hits that dude in the face and he's on fire. The guards get him and he's like, "You guys don't understand. I'm not locked in here with you. You're locked in here with me." And you're like, "Oh, what a badass, you know? God, tough guy." That was Paul's mentality here. I'm in here. These guys are stuck with me. He probably had his Bible open. He's going through Isaiah 52:15 all the way to 53:12, witnessing. He says this at the end of the book. He says, "I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am in." The key, he calls this the secret. He says, "I know how to get along in humble means. I also know how to get along in prosperity. You could be poor, you could be rich. I still know how to keep balance. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need." And so the question is, what is the secret he's talking about? What did he learn as he sat there, this strong-willed man? What had God spoken to him about? We'll find out after break. So let's actually ground our thinking in a passage, not just look at this systematically, where you import all of these passages together, but you actually work your way through a passage. I had an older believer work me through this passage. It wasn't somebody who had discipled me. He just knew I was struggling with anxiety, saw me, sat me down right there, and just worked me right through this passage, and it always stuck with me. So let's read this. Philippians 4, verse 4. "Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say, rejoice." We noted earlier that the term rejoice, kairo, is a verb. It's not a noun. This isn't that feel joy in the Lord always. Again, I will say, feel joy. That would be a noun. This is a verb. This is the decision that one makes when you choose to give thanks. It's when you're looking at your circumstances and your blessings. Much of this is your identity in Christ. Paul was sitting in a privileged position as he was in prison, realizing, "I'm seated at the heavenlies. I'm with the right hand of God. I'm going to eternity. That's forever, relatively soon. Really, nothing is going to happen here that's out of God's control. There's always something to give thanks for and rejoice in." It isn't that rejoicing is a feeling state. It's something that you do. For example, 2 Corinthians 6:10, Paul says, "Sorrowful, yet always rejoicing." Now, how does that fit? If rejoicing is a noun, if it's a feeling state, how can you be feeling joy if you're sorrowful? Or is it, correctly speaking, that you feel sorrowful, yet you're choosing to express joy in God? That I'm in a good situation. I don't feel well. I feel anxious. I feel scared. Yet I'm thinking about what's true, and I'm choosing to give thanks for that. He says in verse 5, "Let your gentle spirit be known to all men. The Lord is near." Gentle spirit in the Greek is epieikes. Literally, it means, according to Bedag, not insisting on every rite or letter of law or custom. Much of anxiety is trying to control things, control people, control the situation. And you feel out of control. It's fear in the absence of actual danger. And you feel like if I could just control everything, we'd be in a better situation. Paul says we need to release that. Release control. You're not in control. You never were in control. You never will be in control. And just give it up. Let your gentle spirit be made known. This is the attitude that you just have where I've got it made. I don't need to fuss over everything and be neurotic. Instead, what we're supposed to do is focus on the thing that we don't deserve, not on everything we feel like we do deserve. He says, the Lord is near. Instead of thinking about what you do deserve, focus on getting Christ, the greatest gift you could ever be given. Then he says in verse 6, here's the imperative, be anxious for nothing. This would explain the fact why people would say anxiety is a sin because of this passage. Do not be anxious. Be anxious for nothing. Now, some people think, well, this is really an impossible command to follow. In fact, people would think, okay, be anxious for nothing. Don't be anxious. Don't be anxious. You feel anxious. Don't be anxious. People think this refers to inactivity. Don't be anxious means to stop feeling anxious. Actually, the more you think about that, the more anxious you become. If you want a way to become anxious, just focus on how you're feeling anxious and how you shouldn't feel anxious. Instead, what Paul's saying here, as he continues, he says, everything and in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. So do you see the connection here? The first part, be anxious for nothing. Okay, well, that's impossible. How do I do that? Finish the sentence. In everything, cast your anxiety onto God. Peter describes this in 1 Peter 5:7. He says, cast your anxiety, merimenao in Greek, onto God because he cares for you, mele. Do you see the wordplay here? Those are the same word. Cast your cares onto God because he cares for you. Or cast your anxiety onto God because he is anxious for you. When I sit and fill my heart with anxiety and worry, that's God's job. God says, I want to play the role of worrying about you and your future and your circumstances and your ability to navigate through life. That's my role. That role is way too big for you. You can't do that. You're not God. And so the solution here is to cast your worry onto the Lord where it belongs. You leave that at the feet or at the foot of the cross with God. He promises to take care of that. He says in everything. So we got to think about this. Oftentimes people work themselves up into a state of anxiety where something afflicts them, which is they realize they're in over their head. They don't know how to handle this. And at that point, it's too late. What you should have been doing is leading up to that point, whenever you feel any kind of anxiety, whenever we enter into any kind of difficult circumstance, in prayer, in everything, we cast that off onto God, onto Christ. You feel anxiety, or you feel anxiety filling your heart a little. And it's almost as if you picture, okay, I got to take that and leave it with God. If you learn this practice, when you get to these big things, these big mountains you can't move, you've learned the practice of working through this and passing that over to God where it belongs. We can't just wait until we feel anxious to do this. It's in everything. Then he says in supplication, the Greek term here, dense, literally means an urgent request to meet a need. So this does not refer to any simple prayer request, any request out there. This is referring to taking your needs before God and urgently requesting him that he would meet that need. It's the attitude, I don't know how to describe it other than this. It's, I've got this need, I'm in over my head, and it's just approaching God in faith and just saying, I can't do this. And at that point, that is supplication. I can't meet this need. You can meet it. I'm trusting that you will do it for me. So it's an attitude here. Then he says, with thanksgiving, that all of this, in everything by prayer and supplication, but it's with this attitude. Paul says elsewhere in Ephesians 5:20, he was always giving thanks. Or he was giving thanks in everything. 1 Thessalonians 5:18. This is actually a really good study. If there's one thing you took away from how to counsel people, I hope it would be this. To teach people and to teach yourself first, this discipline of thanks, to learn, even in any situation. It doesn't mean that we're thanking God for the situation. It means even in the situation, I can still give thanks for something. Paul says in Colossians 4:2, this isn't just an action. It's not just that you give thanks, although that is important. This is also an attitude. Every situation you get into, you develop an attitude of thanks in prayer. Even as I'm asking for requests, even as I'm praying for God to meet a need, even as I'm casting my anxiety onto the Lord, there is still this underlying attitude that God, even if you don't answer that prayer, even if these circumstances don't change, I'm still going to give thanks. I don't care if that happens or not. I know that you're a God of grace. By nature, you're a giver. You want to give. But my relationship with you is not contingent on whether you answer these prayers. There's still something to give thanks for. Here's a jarring passage. You ever notice this? Romans 1:21. That verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all unrighteousness and rebellion of men who suppress the truth in their unrighteousness. For God has made it known to them on their hearts, and he made himself known in creation, so that they're without excuse. For they would not honor God or give him thanks. It's not just the intellectual, God has made it known on my heart, verse 19. He's made himself known in creation, verse 20. It's they wouldn't honor him or give thanks. And what happens as a result, according to Paul? Paul says their foolish hearts were darkened. When we sit in the position of, you know, every single day is a mercy of God. Paul says, in him we live and move and have our being. Every single day I wake up. Oh my God, I'm still here. You're still using me. You still haven't taken away these blessings. My God. He says, every single day when you refuse to honor God and give thanks, this has a poisoning effect on the soul. That your heart becomes darkened. And in Hebrew thinking, which Paul was a Jew, the heart was the seat of the emotional life, the intellectual life, the volitional life, your choosing, your mind, your heart becomes darkened. It's the attitude that when I look out at my life and there's just nothing I can give thanks for, that poisons your soul. And you can't move past that point with God. God will wait. Our secular colleagues have picked up on this pretty quickly. Here's Robert Emmons from the University of California. This is from the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. He notes that thankful people have more positive and optimistic appraisals of one's life, more time spent exercising, and fewer reported physical symptoms. I do believe that there is such a thing as psychosomatic symptoms. Psycho meaning your mind, soma meaning your body. That you can worry yourself into a state where the adrenaline is firing. You're not eating. You're not sleeping. You're not exercising. And it can actually have a physical effect on your body. People who are anxious get sick more. They have worse physical maladies. Eamon says, an effective approach for maximizing one's contentment is to be consciously grateful for one's blessings. There do appear to exist benefits to regularly focusing on one's blessings. He reports more likely to report having helped someone with a personal problem or offered emotional support to another person. The people that give thanks. Now, we're not talking about Christians here. The people who have the most to give thanks for, right? We're talking about anyone out there who just chooses to give thanks for these little things in their life. These are the people who are more likely to help others. They don't feel like they're such a wreck and life has dealt them such a bad hand. They feel like, I've got it made. I can actually invest in what other people need. Eamon says they have greater levels of positive affect, more sleep, better sleep quality, and greater optimism and a sense of connectedness to others. Werenberg and Prince, in their book, The Anxious Brain, these are also secular psychologists and one's a psychiatrist. They write, people who have difficulty recognizing positives are more prone to anxiety, depression, and even addiction. Often, we see this in people who are highly gifted. They have all sorts of gifting. They feel like they really should be somebody. And they never quite feel like they've made up to their own personal goal or desire. You should see some of these people. You know, they have more gifting in their pinky finger than you do in your whole body. You compare yourself to them and you're just like, I don't match up at all. And yet you see in these people, they're addicts. They're drunk. They can't deal with the problems that confront them. So, it's as we give thanks in everything. It's as we make our requests known to God. It's as we have a gentle spirit, giving up control as we rejoice. Here's the promise. It is conditional on verses 4 through 6. We get to verse 7. And here's the promise. The peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Don't you want to have that? Don't you wish you could enter into situations that other people can't and just totally at peace? You don't feel afraid. You don't feel like you're controlled by your emotions, but you can press through. He says it's as we develop verses 4 through 6 that it has a guarding effect. It's as if God himself is standing there at the door of your heart like a bouncer, you know, with big 17-inch biceps being like, no, you can't bring that thought in here. And he's keeping these thoughts out, protecting us. He says in verse 8, whatever is true, honorable, right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there is any excellence and if anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. This doesn't just refer to spiritual things, does it? What does he say? Whatever. It could be anything that's honorable, right, pure, lovely, good, excellent, worthy of praise. I was instructed by a professor. He said, I'll wake up some days. I'll go to the coffee machine, pour my coffee, and just sit there with that coffee and just smell it and say, wow, that smells really good. Gives thanks for it. Sits outside on his back porch. You know, he notices the leaves are changing. Looks at God's creation. Man, this is beautiful. Hey, I'm here another day. I didn't die in my sleep. There must be something you have for me today. I'm here. Whatever you can do. Now, of course, as believers, we got way more to give thanks for than just that. Sometimes this primes the pump, though. I think this is what differentiates between someone who gives thanks and someone like Colossians 4:2, who has an attitude of thanks. They get that check in the mail. Things, they get the nice grade on the test. And it's just a constant turning to God and saying, thank you. That came directly from your hand. And Paul says we have to dwell on these things. That these things, the good things, that there is a propensity in the human heart to move toward the things which are bad. We're wired that way about what a raw deal we're in. And God says, no, I want you to choose instead to dwell on these things here. Then he says in verse 9, the things you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. This is what we have to hit with the person filled with anxiety. There is something for you to do, but it's not the thing that you think it is. I just need to be stronger. I need to be more confident. No. It's you do need to practice these things. And what are these things? The nearest antecedent is verses 4 through 8. It's having a disciplined thought life and spiritual formation where we're approaching God in this way. What was the secret Paul learned? He learned how to rejoice. That's how he could sit there where other people would have cracked up and lost it, cussed out God. You know, Paul still had a couple more years left in him. Philippians was probably written in 62 while he's in prison. He dies in 66. He gets out. He still has a fourth missionary tour. He had a whole bunch more to do for God, but God let him slow down toward the end of his life. What if he had just snapped right there? He didn't. A few more points for battling anxiety. Learn to trust in the sovereignty of God. Solomon, the wisest man ever, writes this, Proverbs 2:8. God guards the course of the just and protects the way of his faithful ones. 3:25, have no fear of sudden disaster or of the ruin that overtakes the wicked, for the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being snared. 4:23, above all else, guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life. 29:25, fear of man will prove to be a snare, but whoever trusts in the Lord is kept safe. Get out from under the fear of man. Wouldn't you like that? What's the solution? It's Hebrew parallelism. Fear of man versus what? Trust in the Lord. How about trusting the Lord? Getting your focus off of people. When we counsel people, we want to help them determine their responsibility with anxiety. Don't let them focus on how they're feeling. They're going to feel anxious. How was this week? I felt anxious this week. Okay, let's not worry about that. Don't focus on your feelings. Focus on, instead, your actions. To put that another way, what was in your control? What did you do that led to you feeling anxious? What was out of your control? I got surrounded by people at work. I got antagonized. I got cussed out. My car fell apart. You can't control that. What was in your control this week? Reflect on God's provision. The psalmist picks up on this. Psalm 77:12. I will meditate on all your work and muse on all your deeds. Yeah, not just the salvation of the Exodus, which is in context, Psalm 77. He says, every single miracle you've done, every provision you've given to me, I'm going to reflect on that. And I'm going to meditate on it. Thank you for it. It's often helpful to get the person to write out how God has provided for them in the past. Remember that really scary step of faith? Yeah, I remember that. What was that like? Scary. What happened after you did it? Felt pretty good, didn't it? Yeah. How did God provide for you when you were in that situation? We need to write this stuff out. I keep an electronic prayer journal, and it starts with 20 pages of answers to prayer. So before I can even get down to petition, I get to look through. Starting in 2004, they're dated. And you look through, God has been with me this whole time. He's still with me. I don't think he's going to leave. I think he's going to be here for this next step as well. urge the person not to think of anxiety in a real binary way. You know, binary code, one or zero, one or the other, A or B. A lot of people think of anxiety as anxious versus not anxious. Every single time you're going to err on the side of feeling anxious. Unless you're Mr. Spock and you wake up and you're a robot. If I reach across the table and I can feel a pulse, you're going to fit on the left side of that column. It's really not helpful. We need to think of anxiety more so in this way, that it's more like a continuum. You might think of this as 1 to 10. So at the end of the day, what was today like? Today was a 9. It was a full-out panic attack. Felt like I was losing my mind. Okay, that's a 9. Friday. What was Friday like? Friday was a 3. Really wasn't that bad. Or it was a 5. Help them to see that there's been progress here. They can look back over the years and see, or the months, and see that there's been change. Don't focus on how you're feeling every single moment. One thing that's healthy is to write out at the end of the day, maybe once a day, how was today? How'd I do? What was it that made me feel anxious? What was it that brought me joy? Start to kind of get a barometer on how you felt that day. Record it. What triggered the anxiety? What was the antecedent that led to it? Sometimes if you can just write out that big scary thing you're worried about, if you can say it out loud, what are you scared about? I'm scared of looking stupid in front of these people. It's almost as if as soon as it leaves your lips and it gets out into the air, you're kind of like, that itself is stupid. How does John Stott put it? Fears are like mushrooms. They grow best in the dark. That always stuck with me. I always liked that. When you keep these anxious thoughts to yourself, if you can just pour them out to God, that's the best place to pour them out, or to other people. To get out into the air and you realize, that's dumb. I don't need to worry about that. Colin says, impatience often accompanies anxiety, and anxious people want help in handling their pressures quickly. It can be very hard to wait for God's perfect time schedule. Show them you're not going to get fixed this week, but there's going to be progress. You might move from a 7 down to a 6. And the week after that, you might stay at a 6. The week after that, you might move down to a 5. It's going to take time. One of the best things that we can do for those people who are struggling with anxiety is to model faith to them. I think when we sit before our people in prayer, when we get through a whole episode where they're talking about this, and at the end of your time together, when you sit before them in prayer, that is a time you should treat very, very seriously. Where you can model what it looks like to express faith in God and trust in Him. When people share, you don't want to panic yourself and get them all worked up. Oftentimes you laugh when they're getting into a real worked up state. You just have to kind of, wow, dude, let's get back down to earth here. It's okay, you know. What are you so worked up about? That's not that big of a deal. Oh, I did this. That was so terrible. Oh, my God, you're getting so worked up. And, whoa, I heard you. It wasn't that bad. It's fine. Model faith and stability. Collins again says, the Christian counselor can be an example of one who is calm and trusting in God to meet needs. Who is that person you go and talk to that when you talk to them, they just feel like a rock? They are screwed in tightly. Their roots are down deep. We need to be those kind of people for others. Biological factors of anxiety. I am one who believes that there can be some biology behind this. Runs in families. I think there's a genetic component. Often exaggerated, I will say. But you got the same DNA as your parents. There's going to be things that are passed down. There's also exterior environmental issues that can come in. Lifestyle, your behavior, your beliefs. You can function a pretty long time until you hit the point where the neurochemistry in your brain is shot, where you're not really learning how to deal with your anxiety. And what it does is you hit a certain point where you can't do it the way you were doing it anymore. And these are these times, I guess you could call this breaking, where God is like, if you're not going to follow my way, you hit a certain point. Or even the strongest willed people, they can't keep functioning the way that they used to. And God will draw a line in the sand and say, are you actually going to deal with this? How about trusting me? Whether this is genetic, whether this is lifestyle, beliefs, maybe it's just a big melange of all of them warped in together in a big crockpot cesspool of anxiety. I don't know. But what it does is, when you're in an anxious state throughout the day, you're firing adrenaline. This burns up neurochemicals in your brain called serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine, which are there to kind of fight back against adrenaline and cortisol. Cortisol is a type of adrenaline in the brain. So if you're going into fight or flight several thousand times a day, if you're dwelling on your fear, if you're worried about things constantly and you're turning jittery, all of these neurochemicals are there to calm you back down. But if you persist like this, if you keep pushing through and you don't actually deal with what's making you anxious, you're going to burn yourself out. Warren Berg and Prince, in their book, The Anxious Brain, they write this. They said, stress responses burn out the immune system, making one subject to illness, and can deplete the supply of neurotransmitters to keep the brain functioning in balance. So there's a number of factors we should confront here. There are the false beliefs. I think that is at the core. Even secular counselors like Warren Berg and Prince, they say counseling is the number one way to deal with anxiety. If you can deal with your false beliefs and what's causing you to feel anxious, that is at the core. That is the fulcrum of dealing with this problem. There's also some other peripheral biological factors. For one, diet. Warren Berg and Prince point out, they call this CATS, the acrostic CATS. Caffeine, alcohol, tobacco, and sweeteners. Sugar, also artificial sweeteners. They show studies. People who are drinking the 80,000 Diet Cokes a day, you know, they said there could be a connection. Caffeine can lead to being jittery, which for some anxious people gets them worked up. Alcohol, by far the worst for people who struggle with anxiety. What this does, it's a depressant. It wears down the system. It's unhealthy. And then eventually, when you come off of it, you feel irritable, worked up, not good. And of course, that would refer to binge drinking. But hopefully we're not doing that. Tobacco and nicotine, mixed results on this, actually. Warren Berg and Prince are physicians, so they're not going to encourage you to smoke, obviously. Nor will I. But they said, if you're really anxious, sometimes tobacco really isn't that bad. And if you quit smoking, it might actually be worse for you. So you might just want to, I guess I'll put it like this. Get one issue solved at a time. If you want to get off the nicotine, I think that's great. But if you're an anxious mess, let's focus on that first. Exercise. Warren Berg and Prince again. Physical activity dissipates the adrenaline released in the stress response. So you're anxious. Your body is filling with adrenaline. Fight or flight. You're worried. You're thinking about that all the time. They said exercise helps the body rid itself of toxins more quickly. The stress response releases cortisol, which is toxic to brain cells. So you got the adrenaline firing. I'm a worried mess. I'm anxious. You got cortisol in your system, which is a neurotransmitter similar to adrenaline. Activated by stress and anxiety, you wear yourself down to the point where you are, I don't know if you've been like this, where you have a couple weeks of anxiety and worry, stress, and you just turn into a kind of a jittery mess. There are counter neurotransmitters in the brain, the GABA neurotransmitters. Gamma-aminobutyric acid are the most important calming neurotransmitters. But when you are adrenalized from worry, when you are depressed, worried, fearful, that can't keep up. And you actually get into a state which is worse than you were before. Werenberg and Prince say exercise uses up the fat and glucose released by the stress response. Exercise raises levels of neurochemicals that promote positive mood and energy. So it burns up all this cortisol, all that leftover adrenaline, which is making you jittery. It actually cleans out your system. They write aerobic exercise is the best because it is a great long-term relaxer, and it may help out at the moments when stress is high. Also, exercise increases blood flow to the brain. It may help generate new neurons. Aerobic and anaerobic. Aerobic is 70% maximum heart rate. The way you can know this is if you're working out to the point where it's hard to talk. So I told her the other day that I had to talk about like that stage. Anaerobic is you can't talk at all. You are running at full sprint. Aerobic and anaerobic workouts discharge pent-up energy and cause neurochemistry changes. The vigorous activity uses up the adrenaline of the stress response and helps to rid the body of toxic cortisol. Exercise. For those of us who are stuck with anxiety, maybe putting down the cats, caffeine, alcohol, tobacco, sweeteners, getting into the gym. A few times a week will accelerate this process a whole lot. Then there's sleep. Sleep is huge. You ever had this happen where you're worried about something, you're stressed about something, and you just decide, I just need a night to rest on this, and I'll wake up and make a decision tomorrow. You wake up the next day, and all of a sudden you're thinking clearly. Why is that? What is it that changed? You know, people say, I need to sleep on it. What do they mean? Why? When you sleep, when you go into REM sleep, the hippocampus, okay, this is the short-term memory center. You don't want every memory you've ever had, right? In a week from now, I don't want to remember what everyone's shirt was that they were wearing tonight. I don't want to remember everyone's phone number. I don't want to remember all that kind of stuff. So throughout the day, you're being bombarded with all sorts of stimulus. When you sleep, this dumps all of that short-term memory, like a computer, into your prefrontal cortex. It's like a memory dump, and you wake up and you're like, whoa, I feel a lot better. Is the person sleeping? Are they getting good sleep? Much of teen depression is because we just don't sleep long enough. Adults need about 7 to 8 hours a night. Teens need 9 to 10 hours. How many people in here actually got 9 to 10 hours of sleep in high school? You know, pushing kids into all this extracurricular everything, AP everything, job, school, and we're filling up their schedule until 10 o'clock at night. And then they got to do their homework. And then we're saying, get back up. Hey, teenagers aren't adults. Stop treating them like adults. They need time to rest. They need time to relax. You know, we're seeing teen depression, anxiety, suicide off the charts. You know where it's happening? It's happening in suburban, upper class neighborhoods. Madeline Levine is an expert on that topic. Her book, The Price of Privilege, she talks about that. The worst demographic for teen depression, non-suicidal self-injury, self-harm, suicide, is upper middle-class white neighborhoods. So how about that? How about we just teach the kid, hey, it's okay to get to bed and get 9 or 10 hours of sleep. That's how you have a well-adjusted kid. Relaxation, important. Teaching people how to just put the work down, relax. Type A people, according to Werenberg and Prince, I like this. There's the type A hardy, and then there's the type A hostile. Type A people are really driven. A lot of anxious people are type A people because they just have to perform. They're goal-driven, performance, high-capacity people. They never feel like they're doing it right. The type A hostile has that attitude with everything. You know, they're cutting the grass. They got to make sure those lines are perfect or they get bent out of shape. They're running errands. They got 5 errands to run. They only got to 4 of them and they get bent out of shape. Okay, look, dude, it's not that we want to turn type A people into kind of like lazy people. That's not the goal. The goal is to turn them from a type A hostile into a type A hardy. Okay, it's cool that you're driven. We like that you're gifted or whatever. But have that kind of precision on certain things, not on all things. You know, you're throwing a birthday party for somebody and it's not picture perfect. That's okay. I'm sure they'll still have a good time. It's going to be fine. Well, I was preparing a date for her and, you know, it just didn't go according to plan. And that's okay. Now, you're getting up to teach and you want it to be a good teaching. Okay, let's take our time. Let's put the work in. But, you know, doing the dishes, who cares? Okay, washing the car, whatever. You need to learn how to relax and let it go. Another way of putting that would be pull the large, cumbersome object out of your butt and chill out. Medication. Medication, I would say, is useful, for sure. I'm not one of these fundamentalist Christians that says don't go on meds. Medication is helpful. What medication does is it boosts the brain chemicals. Maybe your neurotransmitters are fried. You know, for the depressive, they can't get out of bed. They can't have a conversation. The anxiety's gotten so bad, they won't even be around people. They're nervous, sick. Get on some medication. Get some help. Now, what I will say is that medication only works for about 35 to 45% of people. I suspect this is because most Americans who take meds for this kind of thing, they don't change anything else. They just think, I'll get the miracle pill, and all of a sudden I won't be depressed anymore. I won't be anxious. You know, that doesn't really work that way. You want to think of meds as a way to supplement what you're trying to do. Medication will get you up off the couch, so to speak. But then you still got to get into your word. You still got to make some lifestyle decisions, or nothing will change. Medication, if you're working with somebody, you know, they go see the doctor, they're trying to get on an SSRI, serotonin reuptake inhibitor. This will help brain chemistry. It's the most non-addictive drug out there. Have them talk to their doctor, get checked out. You know, do you think this would help? Tell the person it's going to take some time. Physicians prescribe this kind of stuff to make it nice and slow. So you go on it slowly. You increase it slowly, you go off it slowly. We need to tell people when they're a month into the dosage, don't stop taking your meds. That is stupid. Don't do that. You will flake out. Your system can't deal with it. I remember talking to one girl, it's driving me crazy. All sorts of problems, okay? And she was just like, yeah, I just don't take my medication every day. She'll just stop taking it when she starts feeling better. I'm like, dude, it doesn't work that way. It's like antibiotics. You can't just take the first eight if you need to take all 10. It'll come back. So go on it slowly, go off it slowly to avoid such a thing. Panic disorder. This is a form of anxiety disorder. Causes the individual to leap into a state of panic, rapid pulse, rapid breathing. This has been compared to you're in a room like this and your biological system starts to feel like it's as if somebody came in through the door with an AK-47 and started waving it around the room. Just think of how you'd feel if somebody put a gun to your head in front of all these people. You're sweating, you're breathing, you can't control yourself. You're losing it. And yet, you look around the room and you see there's nothing objectively out there as to why I should be feeling like this. People who have a panic attack once are likely to get it back again. There's probably, as we're talking about neurotransmitters, that their system is worn down, that probably caused the inaugural panic attack. Got into a situation. Often it's a benign situation. For some people, they're going over a bridge. And all of a sudden, they start to wonder, oh my God, what if this bridge falls? For some people, it's being in crowded places. All of a sudden, they hit a panic attack. And once they have it once, they start to freak out and think, I'm going to have it again. And this becomes kind of it leads to a state of what they call hypervigilance, where as soon as you start to feel your pulse rising, or you start to sweat, or you start to feel intense, you start thinking to yourself, I'm having a panic attack. Then what do you think happens? You think your pulse goes down? No. Then you start to feel your pulse raise even further, and your breathing's out of control, and you're like, now I'm really having a panic attack, until you basically talk yourself into one. You reach the point where you're losing it. You can't control yourself. Those who have panic attacks, they often feel like, I'm losing my mind. I'm going to die. What's good to know is that panic disorder is the easiest anxiety disorder to treat. This is really comforting. If you're working with somebody who has this, they'll be like, oh my God, I'm going to die. My life is over. Just telling them, you know, the research shows this is the easiest thing to work with. Don't worry about this. Werenberg and Prince say, panic disorder is among the easiest of all psychological disorders to treat. The most difficult aspect of treatment is gaining compliance. So teaching the reason for the techniques must be part of the program. There are certain techniques you can give to people. Maybe there's people in this room who've had this. Okay, here's some techniques that are helpful. Check this out. First, don't avoid whatever's making you go into a panic. It doesn't help. In fact, it hurts. As soon as you start to avoid it, then you start to convince yourself, I really am crazy. I really can't go in. You know, it's always something stupid, driving over a bridge, so I'll go 5 miles out of the way. Or I can't be in a room full of people, so you stop hanging out with people. Or I can't be in that room rather than this room. Or I always have to sit in that chair. Okay, don't avoid these things. Confront them. One of the helpful things to do is actually to study what's happening in your brain when you're in a state of panic. This is because one of the best solutions for panic disorder is what they call diaphragmatic breathing techniques. People who are in a state of panic are breathing in their chest up here. What you need to do is be able to teach yourself. You put your hands on your hips. Just try this with me. Put your hands on your hips and breathe in through your gut. Okay? And I'm going to really embarrass myself here so that you're not looking at each other's guts and you're looking at mine. Ready? You go. You can feel it back like in your kidneys, in your stomach. And you want to, have you ever seen a baby lose its voice? never happens. You know why? Because they breathe through their diaphragm. They can scream for hours. Learn diaphragmatic. So basically these breathing techniques, I won't go into them, but you breathe in slower than you breathe out, and then you breathe in slower than you breathe out. And basically what you're doing is you're telling your brain, I'm fine. I don't need to launch into a big state of panic here and freak out. This isn't New Age thinking. There's a form of it. I think New Agers ripped this off of science. New Age thinking is when we do something that isn't scientific. It can't be tested in a double-blind test, but we put some kind of spiritual phony baloney to it because whatever. No, that's not what we're talking about here. Like New Age thinking is breathe in the good energy and then breathe out the bad energy. No, we're just breathing, okay? That's all this is. What this does scientifically is that it triggers the parasympathetic nervous system to reduce physical arousal. What do I mean by that? It's your brain is saying, there's a guy in this room with a gun, fight or flight, heavy breathing, sweating, go pulse, go nuts, you know. And when you can learn how to breathe your way out of this, this communicates something physiologically to the brain, which says, chill out. It's fine. As a result, the basal ganglia, which is a portion of the brain, which triggers the panic, it's adrenalizing your system. Your cortisol's firing. Oh my God, I'm in a state of panic. When you start to breathe like this, start taking those deep breaths, almost as if you're breathing through a straw. Oh, yeah, just relax, take it easy, it's cool, no big deal. This tells the basal ganglia, chill out, it's fine. Stops firing the adrenaline. So again, not New Age thinking. This is scientific. They can show the science behind this. For those with panic disorder or anxiety, get the thyroid checked. It's a simple test. Costs, I don't know, $50 or something. Make sure that your thyroid isn't going crazy. If it's low thyroid, it causes depression. Hyperthyroid causes anxiety. Then change your thinking.